This is chapter 6. When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, 'I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I have made them.' But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." North Korea's dictatorship is the most repressive government in today's world. The propaganda, peer pressure, and the consequences for refusal to conform to the standards are second to none. The arm of the supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, reaches all the way to the smallest villages and settlements in the northern mountains in the form of countless snitches, informers, and spies. The sheer degree of control is frightening. Say a word, even remotely critical of the status quo of this country or its leadership, and someone will pocket a reward for blowing the whistle on you. In a perverse sense, the text that I just read to you is located at the opposite end of the spectrum. This is a world without government, law enforcement, and not even a pretense of order. Everyone does what he wants to, and with impunity. You may think of an antediluvian Mad Max society. Caprice and violence rampant. The survival of the fittest. The sole principle governing relationships. The point of this cryptic text, which is one of the most difficult texts in the book of Genesis, the point of this cryptic text is to chronicle the growth of lawlessness or sin. Truth is violated with unparalleled ruthlessness that creates an atmosphere of a gathering darkness, a thickening darkness. The human race rushes headlong towards its judgment, which is already anticipated here in verse 7, where God speaks of the flood. The progress of lawlessness is shown in two stages. Stage 1, verses 1 and 2, is a subtle reiteration, a retelling of the fall of Eden, however, with notable differences or modifications. This stage one of the growth of lawlessness is followed by God's response in verse 3. And stage 2 follows in verse 4, again followed by a divine response in verses 5 through 8, and this time much fuller. In fact, the fulcrum of this text is found in verses 5 through 8. So, the pattern of the text is simple: man's initiative, God's response. Man's initiative, God's response. And this pattern also shapes our line of inquiry, namely, how does the growth of sin or lawlessness appear, and what is God's response? Now, to answer the first question, we have to address another: who is sinning? Verses 2 and verse 4 mention the sons of God, a reference as elusive as the Scarlet Pimpernel. The sons of God can refer to two groups. It can refer to either human beings, and they could be of Seth's line, the godly seed, or of Cain's line, the ungodly seed. And we don't need to decide this matter, but it could refer to human beings, because human beings are referred to as sons of God in the Old Testament. But it could also refer to fallen angels. They also are occasionally called sons of God. And neither solution has gained universal support by commentators or theologians. But I consider fallen angels less likely. If the sons of God are demons, fallen angels, then this is what we behold: spiritual beings produce offspring through union with women, a physical union with women. Although fallen angels, as I said, are occasionally called sons of God, so for example in Job chapter 1 verse 6 and Job 2 1, I don't think that we could stretch this text to this extent. Humans can certainly be possessed by demons, and there is plenty of evidence for this, scriptural and non-scriptural. But angels, fallen or not, angels and men can't mate with each other so as to produce human offspring. In the same sense, rabbits and horses can't mate with each other and produce offspring. They're of a different kind. And in Jesus' own words, Mark 12:25 affirms that angels actually are sexless. They therefore cannot mate with human beings. Moreover, notice God's response in verse 3. Stage 1 of this growth of lawlessness, this gathering darkness, is responded by God's words, "My spirit will not abide in or strive with man forever." Which seems to indicate that the perpetrators are human. God's concern here is not with angels, but with human beings. And it is therefore reasonable to suggest that the perpetrators are human and not angelic. Now, this is not conclusive, I understand. But we do better arguing for something than arguing against something anyway. So let me move on and consider the human option. I believe it is more satisfying. First, kings and judges in the ancient Near East were commonly referred to or regarded as sons of God. By virtue of the fact that kings, rulers, and judges or leaders were seen as representatives of God. In their function as leaders, in the power that they garnered, in their position, they were sons of God, representatives of God. So the argument here is simply this. In the ancient Near East, this language of sons of God, it would not have seemed strange to people. It seems strange to me, and I know it seems strange to you. This is very strange, but it would not have been strange to the ancient people. In the Bible, you also have what is referred to as royal ideology. In Psalm chapter 2, verse 7, for example, God's Messiah, the Anointed One, God's King, is called my King, my Son, God's Son. And yes, the reference is ultimately to Jesus Christ, as the New Testament affirms, but it also refers to Old Testament Davidic rulers. They too, by virtue of their function as representatives of Yahweh, they were sons of God. In the same way, Psalm 82, verses 6 through 8, addresses rulers of men as sons of God. And this is beyond the shadow of a doubt, for Jesus himself in John 10:34 affirms this reading of the text, affirms that sons of God in Psalm 82 verses 6 through 8 refers to human rulers. And another use of this phrase with possibly the same meaning is also found in chapter 29 verse 1. The sons of God, I believe, are human judges. Eponymous forefathers, great men, powerful men, charismatic men who came to be famous on account of these qualities. And they acted like kings in their own right, and by doing so, feeling no accountability to either God or man, by doing so and by acting in this way, they even assumed divine prerogatives, so that the sons of God could even be an ironic reference to the sense that we obtain from Genesis chapter 3, verse 22, where God himself affirms that man has become like God by acting the way he wants to, with no reference to God's will. In any case, these sons of God, they live the way they want to. And they do what they want to because they can. And the taking of women that is here described fits well into this picture that we have so far developed. This is the beginning of harem culture. And harems belong to royal figures in the ancient Near East. If you throw everything together, if you put everything together, the picture that emerges is that of king-like figures, people who act like kings, though they may not be anointed kings, but they act like kings, and they even do what kings used to do in those days. But the language is also linked to the fall of Eden, and I alluded to it earlier. The author has chosen vocabulary that is clearly designed to align with the temptation narrative in Genesis chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. Do you remember? Whereas Eve saw that the tree was good and so took of its fruit, you know the rest of the story. So here, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were good. It's the same word as you find in Genesis 3. And they took as many as they chose. Saw, good, and took. The allusion to the sequence of actions that led to the original sin is intentional, and it serves the purpose of highlighting how evil continues to fester as it did from the beginning, and not only this, but how it is now ingrained in the human being as a way of life. And it shows in ravenous behavior that is void of any respect for anyone. Women are singled out, and they are on the receiving end of this careless, callous, brutal life that these men lived because they could. The language of taking, they took women, as many as they chose, it implies abuse. These folks, they don't ask for the hand of your daughter. They simply take her, and if necessary, by force. As I reflected upon this period of time, I couldn't help but remember the way Nazi Germany recruited forced laborers in occupied territories. Fritz Sauckel, who also stood trial in Nuremberg in 1945 and 6, he became Hitler's chief of labor in 1942. And the growing needs of a war economy also created a need on the home front. You needed more and more people to work and to do it as cheaply as possible. And so Fritz Sauckel was given the freedom to use any measure whatsoever in recruiting laborers for Germany's war economy. Within only a half a year, 2 million Russian laborers were brought to places where they are kept like slaves. And indeed, the veritable manhunt that ensued all across occupied territories in Europe can only be rivaled, and it isn't really, certainly not at this magnitude, by the blackest periods of the slave trade among humans throughout history. So here's a snapshot of stage one. There are powerful men, sons of God, who get what they want. They do what they want. And this capricious way of life, quite akin to despotism, shows in the way they build their own clans. They act with total impunity, raiding homes and making off with their booty. Their arrogance, power, and king-like status makes resistance futile. This is stage one. Stage two of the growing darkness is rendered in verse 4. Verse 4, products of this harem culture of the sons of God were the Nephilim, the mighty men of old, the men of renown. All three belong in the same category. As the offspring of those who lived like sovereign kings, the sons of God, they were favored to become great warriors and leaders of clans, famous men who lived by the sword. The word Nephilim, which may mean fallen ones, if you must translate it, is also found in the Septuagint here. It is translated as giants in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew text here, because the same word, Nephilim, in Hebrew is found in Numbers 13:33, where it, beyond the shadow of a doubt, refers to giants, a tribe of giants living in Canaan. Now, whether these men of renown actually were gigantic in stature or not, they were certainly larger than life. And they were famous, but not for their amiable qualities. As verses 11 through 13 show, and I'm previewing next week's text at this point, but as these verses indicate, these men of renown, they were leading the way and filling the earth with violence and brutality. So while stage one describes the hubris of men acting like kings, building their house, stage two introduces their dynasties, would-be dynasties, names of men and of their clans who lived on in the memories of the ancient people. In fact, the phrase men of renown reads, men of the name. They made a name for themselves. Do you remember the story of the Tower of Babel, which is another biblical tale of hubris? People wanting to make a name for themselves in order to take heaven by storm. In the same way, the name, this godlike status and reputation of these legendary men, betokens a way of life independent of God. The name isn't merely another way of speaking of fame. The name competes with God's name and renders it obsolete. Something that we've already seen in Cain's line in chapter 4, where technology, an extension of the human arm, becomes a God replacement. But now let's look at God's response to this gathering darkness. It too comes in two stages. First, God shortens time to 120 years. This can refer to either the time that God gives for the human race until the flood. So this is a respite until the ultimate disaster, or it can refer to a shortening of the lifespan of human beings in general. We don't need to decide this matter. Either one of these fit well with what follows in the narrative. But the important thing is that God affirms the growing hostility, alienation, the growing darkness. And he affirms that he won't be sidelined. God acts with a preliminary judgment. Time grows short as sin is magnified. My spirit shall not abide in man forever. God's second response in verses 5 through 8 clarifies this now, and this is the meat of this passage. Here is a text, like very few texts in the Bible, that gives us a window into God's heart. God is sorry that he has made the human being. So sorry that he decides to destroy him along with every other creature on the face of the earth. Now that is a radical response, and it requires a good explanation, a good rationale. So verse 6 continues in the same vein, asserting God's grief. God was grieved to his heart over the situation. And that's a hint of God's ability to suffer on account of our sin. The chief expression of this God's ability would have to wait thousands of years, however long, when Christ, the Son of God, hung on the cross, suffering for our sins. Here, this is only hinted at, but it is hinted at. And as for sin, sin itself is rendered both extensively and intensively. When spouses have an argument, You will hear words like, "Oh, you always do this," or "you never do that." And then these words, the use of these words, always serves to define the other person. God does define the human condition, but it is not an exaggeration in the way that we use these terms when we argue. No, God's striving with man never leaves the ground of truth. His evaluation is always truthful, always to the point. And here I am at liberty to use the word always, as you also know. God's rendering of the human condition comes with crushing force. Every, only, continually. Every intention of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil continually. I can't conceive of a statement that is more emphatic than this, rendering the human condition. And so God responds by executing judgment on account of the human condition. Hardly a surprise, but there is something else. Also, as a response to the gathering darkness in the world, in response to his agony over what to do with this creation that is running amok, we read in the last verse, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord." I want you to ascertain and not to overlook that this is in response to the gathering darkness. This is God's response to the darkness. Part 2. And the reference to grace, or favor as it's translated, however you translate, is not really material. The reference to grace is a reference to God's choice. This is God's gracious choice of Noah in response to how he feels with respect to the chaos that rules on earth. His agony over this chaos. He judges the human race, but he doesn't make a full end. God also converts his anger into something constructive so that his anger does not merely judge, but it also spells survival for the human being and ultimately salvation for the human race through a person better than Noah, who himself needed saving, as you can see from the flood account. Noah finding grace has nothing to do with Noah's character. Although, I will not conceal this, the next verse, verse 9, which doesn't belong to our reading tonight, mentions Noah's character. Noah was a righteous man. He was a good man. And he stood out without question. But God's grace doesn't depend on Noah's character or anyone else's. God's grace comes first as it comes in the narrative. And God's grace shapes the person who receives it. God's grace. How a single word can change everything. We go about our work every day. We go about our business and we do the best we can. Or maybe we don't because we don't care. We don't care enough. But whatever we do, whether we care or whether we don't, you consider that in everything and in every moment, we depend upon God's grace 110%. No matter where you go or what you do or what you conceive, you are always depending on God's grace. And without this grace, there would be no goodness in any one of us. We would be like demons in whom there is no goodness, and that is why they are not redeemable. We would be like devils. Without His grace, there would not only be no goodness, but without God's grace, we can do nothing. This is what Jesus meant. With any lasting merit, dare I use the word. How will I succeed in my work? How will I succeed as a husband? How will I succeed as a wife? How will I succeed as someone who raises children in this world, and who is responsible for the results of all this, the end results? Grace is like the air that we breathe, the atmosphere. We need it. It must be here in the first place. We depend on it. As I said, 110%. Moses knew this. And he saw his own life, and he saw the lives of his contemporaries in the wilderness, and he saw his own sin, and he saw the sins of his people, Israel. And so he prayed, let the grace of our Lord be upon us and establish the work of our hands. Yes, establish the work of our hands. God heard his prayer, and for us too. Grace has now appeared in the person of Jesus Christ. In him, you can finally see the extent of God's ability to suffer and to be grieved over our sins. Not as an observer, as in our text, but as a sin bearer, one who takes our grief, one who takes our disease to the ultimate place to remove it, one who makes atonement. And at the end of Jesus' life, there was an inscription, a sign over his head, an epigraph. It read, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. We all continue to act like kings in our own right. Sometimes this is clear, sometimes it's not so clear, but we're all acting like kings in our own right, and the spirit of the antediluvians hasn't been swept away by the flood. And that sign over Jesus' cross, King of the Jews, it wasn't nailed there as a testimony of respect for a good man. No. It was a cynical comment that by all human rules and all human standards, Jesus failed miserably. Jesus saw and judged not by the sight of his eyes, and Jesus did not decide what was good by his own judgment, and he did not take what wasn't his or take by force. He gave his life. He refused violence and the use of force. He accepted the violence done to him. But this is God's grace, now in person. Jesus is grace in person. Grace that humbles itself even to the point of death. And therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. He's not a man of renown like these sons of God who made a name for themselves. He's not given this name because he was successful or because he made something of himself or because he was a mighty warrior. He didn't make a name for himself, but God acknowledges the true Son of God who failed by human standards, not by God's though. God raises him from the dead and gives him the name that is above every name and power. The servant of men becomes the true king of the world. And for everyone who sees and believes him, the world has now also been turned upside down. No matter what the world judges or thinks. Yes, and this isn't easy to sell. This isn't popular. It takes grace even to love this grace, doesn't it? But we can learn from the sons of God or from the Son of God. We can live the way we want to for a limited period of time, much less indeed than 120 years. Or we can choose Christ's cross. If you choose him, then your old self must die first. It's true that when you come to be a believer, or when the moment comes that you become aware that I am a Christian, I do believe in Jesus, you have already died because Jesus died and you died in him. He died for you and you died in him, and you died when he died. And when he was raised, you were raised with him. And so you have come to newness of life. That's true. But it's also true that we Christians, we die in pieces. We give away ourselves in pieces, often take back what we have given in the first place as though it was ours to keep. But we die in pieces. And thanks be to God, God's Spirit, the Holy Spirit, the Holy Comforter, abides within us. It isn't as the text says, I will not always abide. He abides within us. And without his presence and grace, what can we do? This past week, Christians celebrated Ascension, the Ascension Day, the day that Jesus presumably ascended to heaven. This movement finally completed his exaltation from earth to heaven, from here to the right hand of God. He who humbled himself was exalted. How often has Jesus used this maxim? It's a wisdom saying, indeed, throughout his ministry. It's one of the defining maxims of his ministry and life. Whoever exalts himself shall be humbled, but he who humbles himself shall be exalted. And when Jesus finally hung on the cross, and when he ascended into heaven, he completed both movements in one. He humbled himself and he was exalted. We follow his example with the same promise of exaltation, but the humility comes first. Grace comes first. By grace, we humble ourselves under God's will. It takes grace to do this. It takes grace to want to do this, and it takes grace to muster the courage to act on it. By grace, we humble ourselves under God's will. And this will of God is so different from the way that our world wills, or the way people willed in Noah's days, so different. By grace, though, and it is only possible by grace, we become like him and share in his exaltation. It isn't easy and it isn't cheap, but it must also be said that just as you can see in the ensuing flood narrative, God's grace will not fail to accomplish this. Even in me, even in you, he will not fail to accomplish it. It will be so. God's grace doesn't fail. And so, as Christians, we're both at the bottom, at the very bottom, and at the very top, like Christ. We're a conundrum, a riddle, a mystery, waiting to be explained, and God will explain it in his own time. A wise man was said to ascend a stairway to heaven every day before his prayer time. An enemy laughed at this and decided to get to the bottom of this rumor. So he lay in wait at the break of dawn, and he saw the sage leaving his house and heading for the woods. He observed how he was logging trees and cutting firewood dressed like a timberman. And he saw how the sage then took this firewood to the home of a poor old woman. And as he peered through the window, he saw him kneeling, lighting a fire in the oven. And later, when the townspeople asked him, "What's it all about with this staircase to heaven?" he said, visibly impressed, "He rises higher than heaven. So is everyone who finds grace in God's eyes." Learn from the Son of God, not the sons of God.